The increased distance from the longboats to the shore meant that Magellan's men would be completely exposed to Lapu-Lapu's spears for a much longer period of time as they waited to land, and it meant that the ships would be so far from the scene of battle that their crossbows and artillery would be useless. By the time Magellan ordered his men to charge, the sky had already begun to glow with the approaching dawn. Pigafetta wrote, 49 of us leaped into the water up to our thighs and walked through the water for more than 2 crossbow flights before we could reach the shore. By this reckoning, the distance was nearly half a mile, and a very dangerous half mile that was, because the men were completely unprotected. Pigafetta wrote, the other 11 men remained behind to guard the boats. Meanwhile, the Cebuan king, prince, and soldiers, confined to their light, maneuverable balangay, looked on, powerless to affect events. As Magellan's men awkwardly waded through the water to the beach, they were confronted by armed warriors prepared for a battle to the death. The Mactanese, emerging from the jungle, numbered not in the dozens, as expected, but, according to Pigafetta's reckoning, 1,500, all from the village Magellan had just destroyed. The ratio of Mactanese fighters to Europeans was 30-1. Magellan had boasted that just one of his armored men was worth 100 island warriors. His estimate was about to be put to the test. Pigafetta wrote, when they saw us, they charged down upon us with exceeding loud cries, 2 divisions on our flanks and the other on our front. When the captain general saw that, he formed us in 2 divisions, and thus we did begin to fight. The musketeers and crossbowmen shot from a distance for about half an hour, but the artillery failed to have any effect on the enemy. The Europeans' predicament grew worse, and the battle intensified. Pigafetta wrote, the captain general cried to them, cease firing, cease firing, but his order was not heeded. When the natives saw that we were shooting our muskets to no purpose, they redoubled their shouts. When our muskets were discharged, the natives would never stand still, but leaped hither and thither, covering themselves with their shields. They shot so many arrows at us and hurled so many bamboo spears that we could scarcely defend ourselves. The besieged Europeans, protected by their armor, awkwardly made their way through this deadly gauntlet to the shore. Gines de Mafra recalled, the beach where they landed is very low, so they left the skiffs very far from the shore. Reaching it, they saw a big village in a palm grove, but there was nobody to be seen. Magellan, instead of rethinking the situation, ordered the men to do the one thing that was most likely to incite the Mactanese, burn their houses. The Europeans set fire to one house, driving 50 warriors armed with swords and shields from their hiding place into the open. De Mafra wrote, they charged down upon our men, striking them with their swords. In the midst of this skirmish, one of the warriors slashed a crew member with his sword, cutting his thigh. He later died from the wound. As the mayhem grew, the Europeans suffered more casualties. Even their armor failed to protect the men against all the arrows flying in their direction. Pigafetta wrote, so many of them charged down upon us that they shot the captain general through the right leg with a poisoned arrow. It was only now, too late, that Magellan realized the gravity of his situation. He finally gave the order to retreat, even though his men were stranded far from the longboats. More than 40 of the Europeans scattered as best they could, while 6 or 7 diehards, Pigafetta included, stuck by the wounded captain general as the Mactanese pressed the attack. Pigafetta wrote, the natives shot only at our legs, for the latter were bare, and so many were the spears and stones that they hurled at us that we could offer no resistance. The natives continued to pursue us, and picking up the same spear 4 or 6 times, hurled it at us again and again. Recognizing the captain general, so many turned on him that they knocked his helmet off his head 2 times, but he always stood firmly like a good knight, together with some others. Thus we did fight for 1 hour, refusing to retire farther. All this time, no one came to the aid of Magellan and his small band fighting for their lives, no Cebuans in their balangay, and no reinforcements from the ships. Pigafetta explained that the Christian king, that is, faithful Humabon, would have aided us, but the captain general charged him before we landed not to leave his balangay, but to stay to see how we fought, an order that Humabon was only too glad to obey. At last, some Cebuan converts showed up in their balangay, but by then it was too late. Friendly fire from the ships felled many of them before they came to Magellan's aid. Meanwhile, Magellan was rapidly weakening from the effects of the poisoned arrow in his leg as the implacable Mactinese closed in and the two sides fought hand to hand. Said Pigafetta, an Indian hurled a bamboo spear into the captain general's face, but the latter immediately killed him with his lance, which he left in the Indian's body. Then, trying to lay his hand on his sword, he could draw it out but halfway because he had been wounded in the arm with a bamboo spear. When the natives saw that, they all hurled themselves upon him. One of them wounded him on the left leg with a large cutlass. That caused the captain general to fall face downward, when immediately they rushed upon him with iron and bamboo spears and with their cutlasses, until they killed our mirror, our light, our comfort, and our true guide. At that moment, the Cebuan warriors finally came to the Europeans' aid. They charged into the water, brandishing their swords, and drove off the Mactinese, who displayed little desire to make war on their neighbors. When the water had cleared, the Cebuans dragged the exhausted survivors into their balangay and delivered them to the Armada's longboats, which remained curiously distant from the scene of battle. Pigafetta wrote, "That battle was fought on Saturday, April 27th, 1521. The captain general died on a Saturday because it was the day most holy to him. 8 of our men were killed with him, and 4 Indians who had become Christians and who had come afterward to aid us were killed by the mortars of the boats. Of the enemy, only 15 were killed, while many of us were wounded." The circumstances leading to Magellan's spectacular, gory death were not, as has often been suggested, an aberration, the result of an unusual tactical error or inexplicable lapse of judgment. Rather, it was the direct outcome of his increasingly belligerent conduct in the Philippines, where he burned the dwellings of people who could easily have been converted to Christianity by diplomacy rather than force. Through frequent displays of his military might, Magellan convinced the islanders and himself that he was omnipotent. It was only a matter of time until he provoked a confrontation with his enemies, who held a decisive advantage from which faith alone could not protect him. His thirst for glory, under cover of religious zeal, led him fatally astray. Magellan was generally at his best, and a far more sympathetic character, when he was the underdog. At such moments his best qualities came to the fore: tenacity, cunning, and courage. When his plan to reach the Spice Islands was turned down by the King of Portugal, not once but many times, Magellan successfully assembled and promoted a mission to the King of Spain. When mutineers seized 3 of his ships in Port St. Julian and nearly captured a 4th, Magellan immediately, and with little assistance from others, managed to reclaim the vessels one by one to end the mutiny. When his officers doubted the existence of the strait, Magellan found it. When they quailed at the prospect of entering the Pacific Ocean, he proceeded to sail into its roiling waters. And it took the massed forces of 1,500 men to kill him. After the furious battle ended, the hacked pieces of the explorer's corpse drifted aimlessly in the water near the beach at Mactan until the victorious warriors claimed them. That afternoon, Magellan's distraught loyalists urged Humabon to send a message to Lapu-Lapu, requesting the remains of Magellan and the other victims of the Battle of Mactan. They even offered to pay as much as the victors wanted in exchange for the 9 fallen warriors. Lapu-Lapu's reply was shockingly arrogant, Pigafetta wrote. They would not give him for all the riches of the world. They intended to keep him as a memorial. That might have been the case, but nothing of Magellan was ever recovered, not even his armor. The officers and seamen of the Armada had long anticipated Magellan's death. Pigafetta wrote, as soon as the captain general died, the 4 men of our company, who had remained in the city to trade, had our goods brought to the ships. With the precious trading cargo, the bells, beads, fabrics designed to entice islanders, safely stowed away, the survivors held an election to select the next admiral of the Armada de Malacca. They sought a man who would, above all, avoid high-risk endeavors similar to those that had endangered and claimed the lives of so many, and who would rededicate the fleet to its primary commercial goal, spices. There was no discussion of disbanding the fleet or turning back. They had come too far and suffered too much for that. Nor was there any shortage of candidates to succeed Magellan. The ranks swelled with rivals and would-be admirals who had long been waiting for this moment. Although the loss of the Captain General was tragic, his death brought a palpable sense of relief that the ordeal of sailing under him had at last ended. When completed, the voting produced an unusual result, electing not one but two men, Duarte Barbosa, Magellan's brother-in-law, and Juan Serrano, the Castilian captain. This outcome did not satisfy everyone. Sebastian Elcano, the Basque mariner who had played a leading role in the mutiny against Magellan at Port St. Julian, believed that Serrano was miscast as co-commander. Elcano thought Serrano a competent pilot, but nothing more. Implicit in Elcano's judgment was the conviction that he was better equipped to lead the expedition. Magellan's loyal servant, Enrique, was even more bitterly opposed to the new leadership of the fleet. Enrique had rendered valuable service with his ability to interpret the Malay tongue, a skill now more necessary than ever, but he refused to leave Trinidad as ordered, claiming that he was suffering from battle wounds. He remained in his bunk, wrapped in a blanket, loudly proclaiming that he was free now that his master was dead. He was correct on this point. In the event of Magellan's death, his will provided for Enrique's liberty along with a bequest of 10,000 maravedis. But the new leaders of the expedition, accustomed to the slave's unquestioning subservience and still in need of his linguistic and diplomatic skills, insisted that he continue to obey orders. Enrique, coming into his own after years of servitude, stubbornly refused to yield to anyone's authority. A loud argument between Enrique and Barbosa ensued. Harsh words succeeded in rousing Enrique from his stupor, and he furiously stalked off the ship. Pigafetta believed that Enrique, on leaving the ship, sought out Humabon, the Christian king, to scheme against the Armada. Pigafetta said that Enrique told the Christian king that we were about to depart immediately, this much is true, and that, if he would follow his advice, he would gain all our ships and merchandise. Pigafetta continued, and so they plotted a conspiracy. Then the slave returned to the ships, and he appeared to behave better than before. Elcano told much the same story. The slave convinced the king that because the Castilians had been plotting against them, there was no other solution for the Cebuans than to plot back against the Castilians. Humabon found himself in a desperate situation. Magellan, to whom he had been loyal, was dead, and the crew was about to depart, terminating the protection Humabon had enjoyed. In the absence of the Armada, Humabon would have to contend with Lapu-Lapu, whose victory over Magellan had emboldened the local chieftain. Because Humabon had sided with Magellan, it was only a matter of time before Lapu-Lapu, seeking revenge, came after him. Pressure on Humabon to retaliate against the Europeans came from yet another direction. Many of the island men resented the way their women had been treated by the Europeans. For all these reasons, plotting against Magellan's men was the most effective way for Humabon to demonstrate his loyalty to his own people and to save his own neck.